Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The New Hampshire primary didn't quite produce a Dewey beats Truman moment, but it was bad enough. Most of the news media had all but called the race and called it wrong in the Clinton-Obama matchup. A new study suggests much of the public is already sick of non-stop campaign coverage, yet we have a long road ahead and a huge national decision to make. Former NBC TV news anchor Tom Brokaw has a few suggestions on how the media can settle down and do better. This hour, On Point, Getting Campaign Coverage Right with Tom Brokaw. In a moment, Tom Brokaw joins us, but first, let's check in on Michigan, where Mitt Romney and John McCain are campaigning hard on the eve of the hotly contested Republican primary tomorrow. Joining me now from Grand Blanc, Michigan, is Juliet Alperin, national political reporter for The Washington Post. She's just come out of a Mitt Romney event. Juliet, thanks for being with us. What is Mitt Romney telling Michigan voters?
What Mitt Romney is telling Michigan is that he's Michigan's son, that he was born and bred here, although he moved away decades ago, and that he would fight for Michigan and focus on the state and its troubled economy and struggling auto industry if elected president.
And what's the message that John McCain is putting up against the native son message?
John McCain is arguing that he's giving straight talk, that he's going to be honest with the people of Michigan and tell them that while some of their jobs are going to go away and never come back because of the shift in manufacturing here, he would focus on revamping the federal retraining program that the country has for workers, and that he would push green technology and kind of new kinds of jobs to replace the ones that are being lost by the domestic auto industry here.
Does McCain have a reply to that? We heard him say not long ago that some of these jobs are not coming back. How's that vision of the future selling with the Michigan Republicans?
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, clearly Michigan Republicans are very pleased that people are focusing on their state. They're unhappy with the current Democratic governor, Jennifer Granholm, and so they're looking for a Republican to kind of show them an alternative policy to help revive the economy. And really what you get the sense of when you talk to voters is that it's an extremely tight race. And essentially, people are very divided. A lot of people, you know, do appreciate that Mitt Romney is from Michigan and that his father was governor here about four decades ago. But at the same time, there are definitely people who prefer John McCain's focus and say that, you know, while it might be a little pessimistic, he's being honest about what the state of play is here.
Has Mitt Romney laid out how he might go about bringing some of that industry back, if indeed it could happen at all? Detroit has not succeeded in some years now in doing that. What does Romney say about how he would approach it?
That's an excellent question, and he's sketched out some details and should sketch out more later. What he really has been talking about is spending more money on research, although, again, the government spends a tremendous amount on research into, say, alternative fuels right now, but he's really talked about expanding that. What he's mainly emphasized is his opposition to a newly signed energy bill, which will impose stricter fuel economy standards on domestic automakers. And this is something that where there's a real split between McCain and Romney, with John McCain saying he backs stricter fuel economy standards, both to help American companies be competitive and also because it will address environmental concerns. And that's something Romney is saying he's adamantly opposed to.
And what about John McCain? If he's saying a lot of these jobs are not coming back and the economy is a big issue in Michigan, does he offer an alternative view of its future, one that has jobs in it? They have the highest in the nation unemployment there, we're told.
Absolutely, and it's almost double the national average. What John McCain is outlining is the idea that they can take advantage of, for example, his commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions linked to global warming nationwide, and in fact they should be focusing on renewable energy ventures, and that might be one of the ways, because they obviously have a number of engineers here, people who've been tied traditionally to the auto industry, that in many ways they may be well positioned to take advantage to, for example, what surely will be more government money flowing to those kinds of renewable energy initiatives.
Juliet, I'm almost afraid to ask after last week's New Hampshire debacle, but what do the polls say about this matchup at this point?
frankly, the polls are, they're conflicting polls, of, and all of them are quite close. So at least I could take a little bit of a cop-out on that. And so, you know, I would say there's certainly a number of polls with Romney having a slight edge. There are a couple with McCain having a slight edge. So we're not getting any kind of clear signal. And I would say it's going to be very close, and it would be entirely unpredictable at this point, except that, you know, it would be, the real surprise would be if Mike Huckabee could capitalize on, for example, evangelicals in Western Michigan and leapfrog ahead of these two, but that does not seem likely at this point.
So close, and maybe too close to call, and that may be a mercy this time. Juliet Alperin with The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you.
Juliet Alperin joined us from Grand Blanc, Michigan there. Joining me now from New York is Tom Brokaw, anchor and managing editor of the NBC Nightly News for two decades, from 1983 to 2004. He's been in the news business since 1962, and last week joined in election coverage and analysis for MSNBC on the night of the New Hampshire primary. He made some waves when he gave a gentle on-air rebuke to his colleagues in the media for rushing to judgment in New Hampshire, and he's gone on thinking and talking about coverage of the 08 campaign. His new book is Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. Tom Brokaw, welcome to On Point. Thanks a lot for being here.
Tom, it's good to be here.
So what did you learn and think on the hoof last week as you watched these results come in after all the anticipation and prediction, Mr. Brokaw?
Well, what I said to myself was that, Brokaw, listen to yourself, because I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post last summer saying my favorite theory of American politics at this stage in the campaign is the UFO theory, the unforeseen will occur. We are obviously in a great scramble here, and New Hampshire was the apotheosis of that in the early stages in terms of the voters are making up their own mind, and I happen to believe, and I have no firm data to support this, but I happen to believe that in places like New Hampshire, where the voters are, as we know, historically independent and a little contrarian, they say, they think I'm going to vote this way, watch this, and make a late decision to go in the other direction.
Tom Brokaw, let's relive just a moment of that egg-on-the-face moment when it began to dawn on everybody that this wasn't going to be as it had been so loudly called. Here's just a little bit of tape where you're on air with Hardball host Chris Matthews having a post-game or vote discussion on MSNBC about the media's rush to judgment. In the background, we can hear the noise and the music from candidate campaign headquarters. Chris Matthews begins, Tom.
So even the pollsters that were right about the Democratic race, or close to right, were wrong about the other one. Tom, we're going to have to go back and figure out the methodology, I think, on some of these.
Well, you know what I think we're going to have to go back and do?
Yes, sir.
Wait for the voters to make their judgment.
Well, what do we do then?
What
in the days before
idea.
The balloting, we must stay home then, I guess.
No, we don't stay home. There are reasons to analyze what they're saying. We know from how the people voted today what moved them to vote. We can take a look at that. There are a lot of issues that have not been fully explored during all of this. But we don't have to get in the business of making judgments before the polls have closed and trying to stampede and affect the process.
Trying to stampede the process, that's big. Tom Brokaw, on air, we heard you and Chris Matthews talking it out. What about off air? You heard Chris Matthews say right there, right away, look, if we're not predicting what's going to happen, what the heck do we talk about in all these hours?
We're still having that dialogue about the tone that we should have on election night. Look, one of my big issues has been that we have very strict rules about using exit polling not to call an election before all the polls have closed. But the line between exit polling and strong judgment or opinion on the part of the people who are on the air seems to have disappeared altogether. We used to develop sometimes kind of weaselly language, but it was always cautionary. If the current trends hold up, it does appear that kind of conditional judgment that we would make. That's all gone out the window, and it's not just at MSNBC, by the way. It's across the board. And if I were a voter in one of those states, I would deeply resent it. I'm still going there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, making up my mind, and I'm listening to the radio or watching television, and they're telling me that it's all over. This is the way it's going to go.
But what do you say to Chris Matthews' response right there immediately on the air, in effect, Tom, if we can't talk about what the outcome's going to be, how are we going to fill all these hours?
There are lots of ways to fill the hours, Tom. I mean, for one thing, you can talk about the parsing of the issues with the candidates. People are taking this election more seriously than anyone I can remember, probably since 1968, and before that, 1960. There are grave issues. We are at war on two fronts in Iran, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran is on the horizon. At the moment, Pakistan is a burning fuse. We've got a war going in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Here at home, we've got a foreclosure crisis of epic proportions underway. They say there's a worse second wave coming. There are lots of economic stimulus programs that are now being proposed by these various candidates. These are all matters that are worth discussing rather than just the easy business of saying, here's who's going to win and who's going to lose and what the effect will be. At one point in the evening, when it was clear that Hillary was going to win, Chris said to me, well, what's this going to do to Mark Penn, who's her pollster?
Yes.
I don't think our audience cares much what it's going to do to Mark Penn.
Not just her pollster, but at the top of her campaign effort, there was talk of him and others potentially being gone. You're saying, forget all that inside baseball stuff. Look at these giant issues sitting in front of us.
Let's keep our eye on the larger issues that are at stake here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about getting campaign coverage right with former NBC TV news anchor Tom Brokaw. What's your take on how the media got it so wrong in New Hampshire? And is the media telling you what you need to know about the 08 campaigns? Is it too wrapped up in the horse race? Is it too wrapped up in its own bubble? Tom Brokaw's new book is Boom, Voices of the 60s. Let's just remember what the tone was on the eve of that primary vote in New Hampshire. Here's Joe Scarborough, MSNBC, one of the many commentators to get swept up in Obama mania out of Iowa before New Hampshire. He spoke on the day of the primary before the results were in.
It's just got to be huge for Obama. You look at the crowds. Everywhere you went, there was excitement on the ground. Independents were flooding there. And then you go to a Hillary Clinton event. We went to one last night. And when Hillary Clinton got up there, I was thinking, you know what? She would have been a great standard bearer in 2004. But the rules of the game have changed.
Maybe, maybe not. After that primary, CNN host Lou Dobbs appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
I was watching the New Hampshire coverage.
Right.
I enjoyed a lot of things about CNN's coverage.
Thank you.
Much of it unintentional on their part. But you, at the end of the night, you actually offered a bit of a, you said maybe we should all apologize for getting it so wrong. I thought that was a really interesting, how'd that go over in the newsroom?
I was embraced warmly by all of my colleagues saying, you're right. It was good to point out our failings as journalists and newsmen. The truth is that most of us, I think, understood that we had perhaps overstepped in terms of forecasting the results, going too much with the polls and the days between Iowa and
New You're suggesting New Hampshire. Inaugurating Obama was the wrong move.
Probably just something short of a coronation would have been more appropriate.
Lou Dobbs with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Tom Brokaw is with us. He was an anchor of the NBC News for many, many years. Now, Tom, let me ask you, I'm looking back at the history here. We want to, you know, compare in a way that's just and fair. 2000 was not exactly an easy election race. After the calls that were made on, you know, Al Gore in Florida, the back and forth on that, you and your buddies Peter Jennings and Dan Rather were very contrite. Dan Rather, Country Dan, said he felt lower than a snake's belly about the performance that night. You said in 2000, not only do we have egg on our face, we have a whole omelet. So what's different here? Is this worse? Was it really so good in the old days?
Well, what has happened is that you have all of these cable channels operating 24/7 and all this time to fill. And one of the other lines I used the other night, it's a failure of our imagination in finding other ways to fill it, and I think we have to think about that. And there are discussions going on about that. It's just too easy for everyone to be a pundit and to be, and to borrow a horse racing term, a tout. We're all gathered around the betting window, and everybody's got a horse right here. His name is Paul Revere, and if the weather's clear, can do. And to borrow a line from Nathan Detroit, and there we are. And I think that's a mistake. I think we have to take a deep breath, stand back, see that this process is probably going to play out for a while. I was talking to a very prominent Republican over the weekend who said to me, I wouldn't be surprised if the Republican race went all the way to the convention. Yeah. I am a little surprised, he said, that no one's begun to form a delegate selection committee of some kind, because they may be trying to round up delegates come June or July.
When you said on the New Hampshire primary night that the media should stop trying to stampede, in effect, the process, does that suggest that the media or some part of it or some folks within it know where they want it to go and they're trying to stampede it
well,
in that direction?
I think some people plainly get invested in their in what they perceive to be their wisdom, and they're trying to advance it in some way. I think it was on Jon Stewart the next night
yeah.
he called me and said he was going to use a portion of what I had to say, and he ran the gamut of all the people who confidently predicted that Obama was going to win. And they were not just the usual people who play on cable. A lot of longtime veterans in this business were saying it as well with great confidence. Then he came to me at the end, and I said, everybody take a breath. And he said, well, that's what the old guy had to say, and referring to me. No, I don't think that they're trying to move it necessarily in one direction or another, but they get heavily invested in their judgment. They go up to New Hampshire, where Obama did have very big crowds. There was a palpable air of excitement about it. And if you feel that way, that's one thing, but you don't have to necessarily go on the air and make the declaration. What you can do is condition and say just that he's had very, very big crowds this week. He seemed to be picking up people. We don't know where this is going to end up, but based on the conversations that we're having with the Clinton people, they're very nervous about what's going to happen in New Hampshire. That's all legitimate, and that's appropriate journalism.
Tom, I wonder if that's enough anymore, though, to get the ratings, to get the audience that people want. Is there a kind of group dynamic? Yeah.
Just anecdotally, Tom, based on the number of emails that I had, many of them from strangers, and the postings of a lot of bloggers, they thought that everybody had gone over the line this time. Even people who were not Hillary fans said to me, "Thank God you spoke up and said something." Because I think that there's a general feeling in the country that the political system has been taken away from them at the national level by the presence of very big money and these almost corporate machines that are organized around campaigns now. And then when they tune in on the air, they don't feel a part of that as well. It's reduced to selected panels on each of the cable outlets and so-called experts talking with great certainty. And it is, after all, the voters' game that we're talking about on those Tuesdays. It really belongs to them, and it's their voice that we want to hear, and we want to understand why they voted the way they did, and we're not paying enough attention to that.
But you remember the pressure that was there, let's say, in 2000, to be the first out with results that led to that omelet on the face. Now watch these guys. I mean, I sit the night before New Hampshire. Here I am. I'm watching Chris Matthews and this gang, along with 1,000 other things, and I'm noticing, my gosh, they're so certain. They're so certain. How can you go on the air and be sort of mamby-pamby about it if the big guns are just calling it? Boy, maybe I'd better be absolutely certain about that I know what's going to happen here, too.
See, the process is stampeding you as well, son. You've got to have courage to stand up to it.
Yes.
Well, I must tell you that late that afternoon, I felt that Hillary was going to lose. But I didn't say that on the air. I didn't go on the air and say I'd been up there the week before. I'd been doing some soundings. I'd been calling people around. And then I remembered two cautionary tales. One was I interviewed a group of independent voters on the Friday before the election, and one woman who has been very active in organizing independents in New Hampshire, where they now represent 45% of the vote, said, you know, I'm just not going to decide until I get into the booth. I don't know. I want this process to go on because these are important issues. It's the most important election I can remember. And then another man from the Manchester Union Leaders said to me, look, don't count Hillary out. She's extremely well organized here. We don't embrace change with the same fervor that they do in Iowa. And the independent vote will get divided up between Obama and McCain. And she's got a very strong cadre of people, helped by Jean Shaheen, the former Democratic woman governor of the state, who are going to be out there getting out their vote. So those were telltale signs to me. And I thought, I'm not going to go on and put my suspicions on the line or my instincts on the line about who's going to win this one. Let's wait and find out. I've sat through too many election nights to make that kind of a judgment. In 2000 was the classic example of that. And then in 2004, you may remember, during the day early on, we had these exit polls that turned out to be wholly wrong as well.
Kerry's crew was all excited. It looked like they had it.
Yeah, they had John Kerry carrying Virginia, and at 1:30 in the afternoon, I was talking to our numbers wizard, and Shelley said to me, Tom, I'm going to give you the states that we've got them in the first wave, but I don't believe them, and when I read them to you, you won't believe them either. And when I got them, I turned to a couple of my friends. We were having lunch, and I said, here they are, but I don't believe this.
So maybe
it doesn't make sense.
Maybe New Hampshire's done us a favor by tapping the brakes a little bit, slowing everything down, letting us take a sober look at what's going on. Tom Brokaw, lots of listeners, maybe voters, want to join the conversation with you. Let me go to Des Moines, Iowa, and Patricia first. Hi, Patricia. You're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
And just wanted to say it's an honor to have a chance to have a conversation with Tom Brokaw. I did want to say, as I was listening, also, Mr. Brokaw, you mentioned the pundits, and from the state that went first and the state that was beaten up with the media and with everybody being here for a full year before our first caucus.
Right.
I think one of the ways that everybody got it wrong is, from a point of view here, there was so much media attention on, oh, here Barack is this big rock star. Oh, Hillary, she's got the pass. And so one of the things that happened is the media really started to drive it and really, really made decisions for people. And I see this in election after election where you get people saying, well, this is what they want, here's what they want to do. And so on the backside, being a caucus goer, when I was inside the caucus,
yeah,
what I heard was, boy, I really like Joe Biden, love Joe Biden. But you know what? The media said he's not viable, so I'm going to go for Edwards, or I'm going to go for Obama, or I'm going to go for somebody else. And so I think that what happens then is there might have been some backlash on that, as you were saying, when you get to New Hampshire, people telling me what I'm supposed to be thinking. And in terms of, hey, I'm the media, I have this thought. I have made my mind up. And it comes through so loud and clear, well, this is what should happen.
And pretty soon it's all cycling back on itself right there onto the caucus floor. Tom Brokaw, how about it? On the one hand, it can get to be an effort almost at self-fulfilling prophecy. On the other hand, if news reporters are out there and they feel excitement around a particular candidate of a new or different kind, isn't it their job to report it?
No question about that. And I think that the reporting has been responsible and fair in tracking the campaign of Barack Obama. You remember 6 months ago, a lot of people were saying his campaign has stalled. He's not doing as well. And it did pick up pace later in the fall, and he did seem to evolve as a candidate, gaining in confidence. I was in Iowa two weeks, I guess, before the caucuses, and I talked to some very senior Democratic people, and I thought they had the best summary. They said Obama is a rock star. His message is not yet as coherent as we think that it should be. Hillary is easily the best organized and the most experienced, but we worry about her electability. And John Edwards has been here a long time, and Iowans are very comfortable with him, so we think he's going to do well. And I think you saw that reflected, but not one of them said to me, here's how it's going to finish, 1-2-3. They all believed it would be closer than it was, but that it would be jump ball in some fashion.
Let's go to Joanne in Savannah, Georgia. Joanne, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think this is a really important subject. I have been a political junkie for years. I've watched MSNBC and Chris Matthews and Joe Scarborough, and since he kind of changed over to being a Democrat. And I'm really amazed that they're treating this election the same way they did the run-up to the Iraq War. They just buy whatever it is, and then they push their ideas forward, and they think that we should buy that.
Now, what do you mean buy whatever there is? There's a lot of options out there, and they're talking with lots of candidates.
Oh, that's true. If you read the New York Times and you read a lot of newspapers and you watch a lot of television and you think for yourself there are a lot of options out there. But if you watch MSNBC or the local or the national news, it's for the Democrats, it's Obama and Hillary. That's it. It's over.
Well,
that's what they say.
Yeah, they say, so the capital T, they is there, and it's hard to fight that. Maybe. Here we go again, Tom Brokaw. You know, Joanne doesn't want them to leave out the Edwards and right on down the list. On the other hand, polls show a lot of Americans lining up around the top ones. Is there too much pressure to make it a, you know, a two-way race?
I think if you look on the Republican side, that the voters have been very independent. Mike Huckabee and John McCain are now two of the leading contenders for the Republican nomination. They were not getting anything that resembled a consensus favorable treatment
for sure.
from the news media a couple of months ago. John McCain, who I've followed for a long time, know him pretty well personally. I thought he was toast last summer when his campaign began to fall apart and money was running dry. But as I said on election night in New Hampshire, don't ever overlook the indomitable will of a man who spent 5.5 years in a prison in North Vietnam and sees this as really, I think, the culmination of his life's work, this campaign. And he's not given up, and he does appeal because he's got these great roguish qualities that add up to a lot of people to a kind of an authentic character, and that's what they're looking for. Well, Mike Huckabee has touched a nerve, too.
Yeah, but toast was the word all over the place on John McCain.
It was.
And we don't
it
have Chris. We don't, well,
but I didn't say it on the air, Tom. That's the important
but
thing.
But lots of people did. Chris Matthews did. Lots of other people did.
Yeah.
We don't have them there to speak to that, but I can hear them saying, look, he had no money left. He was laying off all his campaign staff.
Right.
He was sitting alone on a bus. If that's not toast, what is?
Yep. That's wrong. And you know what? The wisdom always resides in the voters. They make up their minds and decide what they want to be and what they want for a president. If you go back to 2004, the Democrats thought they could not lose. I was with John Kerry on the Thursday before election night, and he said, any candidate who's been ahead at this stage has always won the campaign. And on the following Tuesday, he lost, and he lost by a pretty significant plurality in terms of the popular vote.
Let's take a call from Watertown, New York, and Terry. Terry, you're on the air with Tom Brokaw.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
You got snow up there, Kerry, by the way?
Actually, no.
We got a lot right here in Boston, and it's on the move. What do you think, Terry?
Well, we're looking forward to seeing the snow. My comment is that the issue are the issues. I am trying to pick a leader for my nation and make an intelligent choice. And in order to do that, I would like to know what these people actually think. So, point in case, presidential debate on the Democratic side with Wolf Blitzer. I would have appreciated it if Wolf Blitzer would have allowed the candidates to actually answer a question without interrupting them, without cutting them off. I feel that during the presidential debates, the greatest favor that the media could do for me is to change the format, to actually allow the candidates time to answer questions in an intelligent and informed fashion.
Not just a show of hands on this or that at worst. Tom Brokaw, what about it? Is the debates where the issues can really be aired out or somewhere else?
Well, I think it's going to get better because we're going to get down to a smaller number of candidates. In Nevada tomorrow night, Brian Williams and Tim will be on the air with John
Russert,
and Hillary and Barack Obama. And one of the penalties for having this thundering herd at the beginning of the process is that everybody gets to get on stage, even though we know that the chances of some of those at the very end of the line are the very remote possibility they're going to do very well. They do get that opportunity to appear on stage in a debate, and then that puts real time constraints on it. Now we should begin to have more of a dialogue, and I would hope from now on out we'll talk about in some detail these economic issues that all the voters are saying they're very worried about.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about getting campaign coverage right with former NBC TV news anchor Tom Brokaw. Of course, he wrote The Greatest Generation, huge bestseller about a decade ago, and he's out very recently with his new book, Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. Last week, he was very much in the news as he helped interpret the news on New Hampshire primary night when the media got it so very wrong. In just a second, we'll hear from Mickey Kaus. Let's listen first to how the campaigns are responding to this whole kind of pushback on the media's flop or failure in New Hampshire. Here's Rudy Giuliani. This is an ad he's running in Florida where his campaign is focusing its energy, capitalizes on anti-media sentiment. The ad uses a swirl of images and sound from media talk shows as a backdrop to the announcer's message.
With pundits handicapping the campaign like the Super Bowl, it's easy to lose sight of what's at stake. An economy in peril, a country at war, a future uncertain. The media loves process. Talking heads love chatter. But Florida has a chance to turn down the noise and show the world that leadership is what really matters.
Rudy Giuliani in an ad there playing in Florida, very ready to take a whack at the media to sort of, stand up on the shoulders of the problem we saw in New Hampshire right away. Tom Brokaw's with us from New York City right now from Palm Beach, Florida. We're joined by Mickey Kaus, political writer and blogger for Slate.com. His Kaus Files blog has been focusing on campaign coverage and the candidates. Mickey Kaus, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to be here.
You know, a lot of people are looking all the way along the food chain and putting the fickle finger of blame on the bloggers, saying they've cranked up the urgency. They're 24 hours. They're so opinionated. It's the bloggers who are pushing all the rest of the media to get more opinionated, lean too far forward, maybe fall on their face. What do you say, Mickey?
Well, I think the bloggers certainly are pushing the rest of the media to become more opinionated, but I don't think that's what happened really in New Hampshire. I think, you know, most people don't read blogs. What's happened is there's a guy, a political consultant named Jerry Skernick, who has the theory of the two electorates, and he says that compared with 20 years ago or 30 years ago, those who are informed are much better informed because they read the blogs, they go on the web, but people who don't follow politics, which is the majority of people, are actually less well informed than the era when everybody watched Walter Cronkite and you learned a little bit about what was going on in the race. And they don't focus until the very last minute, it turns out. We learned in New Hampshire. And, you know, in a rush, they try to find out everything they know. But what happens on the last day is very important to those people. And I think that, rather than the bloggers, is what produced the surprise in New Hampshire. Remember that Hillary's people thought she was going to lose, too.
So they were saying, not everybody reads the bloggers. We get that. But is it possible that... I mean, you know, the media is like a giant organism, and the media reads the bloggers, so could the bloggers drive everything off a cliff, even if most people don't read them?
Well, the bloggers can certainly drive the media off a cliff. I mean, that's my goal in life, is to drive the media. That's the only power I have. But, you know, it's more than that, because the press was gloating at Hillary's, what they thought was Hillary's impending demise. I mean, I was told when I hung around with reporters, oh, you got to go to this Hillary's last rally. It's going to be like the last helicopter out of Saigon.
Oh, geez.
And people were, you know, and Hillary's people were antagonistic to the press, so it was a mutual resentment there. I sort of wonder if Hillary's people even fed the fire because they knew the voters were going to react against the media bias against Hillary, but I guess that would be too sophisticated.
Tom Brokaw, what do you say here? You got in the business in 1962. That's a long time. You're writing about the 60s in your new book, Boom.
Yeah.
When you look at how things worked in those very early decades and then on through your career compared to how they work now, how do you see the 24-hour cable and the Internet, the bloggers, spinning the cat here, or are they?
Well, I do think that there are within the smaller universe. I think that Mickey is right in terms of reaching the wider universe. I think most voters don't read the blogs. I would take, I guess, one exception to what Mickey had to say about New Hampshire voters. I think that they are very well informed, but they are famously and historically undecided going into the last day, and they're contrarians. I think that most voters in New Hampshire who participated in the process probably were paying a lot of attention to what was going on. They just were not going to be moved or stampeded, is the phrase that I use, by what was going on over the air. The bloggers operate in one universe, and the people on cable television operate in an entirely different universe, and the people on cable television now are reaching more folks yet, and that intersection is coming pretty swiftly because everybody is moving to the smaller screen, and it is going to have an impact on how we vote. As I go around the country, I say to folks, look, one of your jobs is to sort out who you believe and who you can trust, who turns out to be reliable, and who's just trying to manipulate you in some fashion. I love the idea of blogging and the vast reach of the internet. I think it's a new form of democratic participation that we should welcome. But at the same time, you know, you have to decide which of those bloggers work for you and which ones you've come to trust and show some wisdom and some insight and take you to places that that you may, A, want to get to, or B, that you hadn't thought about before, and they do it in a way that expands your own horizons.
But as a former anchor man, Tom, do you think that the mere existence of the bloggers and their 24-hour nonstop postings and the high opinion and attitude level of the bloggers, does it inevitably bleed over into the mainstream media and what we hear from
Well, to some degree. I think to some degree. I don't think it's reached it yet. I think generationally, as younger people who are growing up with this, what is now a phenomenon and will soon and is rapidly becoming a fixed part of our lives, as they grow up with that and as they take their positions behind the chairs or on the air, that will be a much more a part of their culture. But I think that there is a separate universe of all news all the time and politics as sport and people participating just like sports writers do before the Super Bowl. That's another metaphor that I've used. How many times have I watched all the activities going into Super Bowl weekend and all these sports writers and football experts saying very confidently what's going to happen and why it's going to happen, and then the ball is kicked off and the game takes an entirely different direction.
Mickey Kaus, how about it? Upside and downside of the blogging contribution?
Well, I worked at Newsweek for a couple of stints, and
right.
they're like all media, they're wrestling. What they wanted was attitude. You know, they knew that they didn't have the news to sell anymore because
it's everywhere.
Cable and it's everywhere, and nobody waits till the end of the week to find out the news. So all they had to sell was voice and attitude, and that you know, it's hard to distinguish that from opinion. So what Tom talks about is present in the mainstream media even without the blogs, and the blogs just magnify it by 100-fold.
Yep.
I guess trying to defend my late decider theory, there was a very high percentage of undecided people who told pollsters, you know, 18%, 15% that they decided on the last day, and that's much higher than normal. Normally, I heard John Zogby say it's 4 or 5%. So it's sort of unprecedented volatility. I don't think it's just because the race was close. I think it's sort of like Federal Express. When you can mail something faster, you wait until the last minute to mail it. So people can find out information faster on the web and 24-hour cable. So they naturally tend to say, well, I'll just find it all out the night before. And you run into these voters who say, I Googled all the candidates' position papers, and in 3 hours I decided.
They can check it out on their BlackBerry on the way to the polling.
I agree with Mickey on that. Yeah. In most states, I always say to people that I've been doing this for so long, and we get we start breathing heavily 6 months before the election, and then you go out to a state, and 3 days before the election, you go have coffee in Iowa, or if you're down in South Carolina somewhere, and you drop into a diner. And you say to a voter, "Well, you know, my wife and I are going to take the newspapers tonight, and we're going to start going through it, and we're going to start making up our mind." I think New Hampshire is the exception to that, because they're professional voters at this point, and they love to be courted, and they're famously skeptics as New Englanders, and the great line has always been, if you say to a New Hampshire voter, "Well, what do you think of Barack Obama?" "Well, I don't know yet. I've only met him 6 times, so I'm waiting to, you know, decide what I think."
And maybe waiting to stick it in the eye of the media if they call it too early and too confidently.
They decide on their own terms, but I think Mickey is dead right in terms of what happens with late deciders in other states. Florida is a big one that is coming up, and my guess is that down there in the condominiums and in the backwaters of Florida and the rural areas, and in those areas where they've got a lot of for sale signs and homes, that folks are beginning now to talk about who they like and who they don't like, and they'll take a good long time before they make up their mind, because they're about to be courted and they know that.
But can't you just feel the exasperation of the talk show folks, and I don't exempt our own show here, to get close to those elections and not be able to talk about who's in the lead, who looks like they're going to take it. I mean, Chris Matthews will be choking on his microphone. Let's get a call from Boston. Gustavo, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling just to say that one of the things that I see, and not just in the swamps of cable news, but also in the Washington Post nowadays and in the New York Times, is that you're running political coverage like an ESPN pregame show. It's all about the predictions, the personalities, the standings. Then the second thing that I saw is the Politico.com wrote a mea culpa. And in that mea culpa, they repeated something that you've heard a lot in the establishment media, and that is that Drudge rules our world. And they talk about Drudge and Real Clear Politics and all these right-wing gossip news sites sort of running their world. And by the way, Mickey Kaus is somebody who has done some of the ugliest coverage of this election cycle. Luckily, nobody actually sees his work.
Oh, that's harsh. What do you mean? What do you mean, ugliest?
Stuff about John Edwards' love baby and trash like that. I mean, he does write some filthy stuff on his site. I'm a political tourist, so I went up to New Hampshire, and what I saw was journalists who didn't know how to ask an open-ended question, who carry their reporter's pads like a shield against the people who are at the show. Or at the event, sorry, I call it mm-hmm. a show. And then they hang together like a clique of nerdy kids at a junior high school dance. And it's weird because I remember going to an Obama rally. By the way, I'm an Edwards supporter. I remember going to an Obama rally and talking to the people, and people had told me how great Hillary had been at the in Nashville just a few hours earlier. But you can't get that if you're walking around the room with a shield in front of you.
Well, I'm sure that they'd hate to describe it that way, but maybe there is some of that dynamic. Mickey Kaus, our colleague Gustavo, says, you know, Drudge et al. Drive it hard. He doesn't like some of your driving either.
Well, Drudge does drive a lot of coverage. Reporters do hang together like kids at a high school dance. That's definitely true. The John Edwards thing, that was a story in the National Enquirer that just because it's in the National Enquirer doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong. I understand why the Edwards campaign would like to have it go away. Every reporter knows about it. A lot of them don't report it. Everybody knows that the story exists. They don't know the story, and I don't know whether the story is true or not, but it was reported. And out of deference to Elizabeth Edwards, I think they held off covering it, and that was probably the right decision. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist just because John Edwards' campaign would rather it didn't.
Or that it does exist because it's been reported. I mean, we've seen how those things can float away. To talk to John McCain in the South Carolina primaries, on the last cycle.
Right. And we're going to see some very ugly stuff this week. But after Bill Clinton said that all these stories weren't true and then most of them turned out to be true, people are justifiably skeptical of the skepticism.
Tom Brokaw, is there a way to turn to the issues and really lay them out there with the seriousness and maybe even repetition required, because some of them are very complex, that's going to keep American voters tuned in not just to the polls but to the media? The media wants people to pay attention. Will the issues bring Americans to the TV, to the radio, to the newspaper and magazine?
Well, I think that they have on Sunday morning talk shows, for example. One of the great advances in political dialogue in this country is that it used to be you just had Meet the Press and Face the Nation on Sunday mornings. Now you've got Tim and Meet the Press and George Stephanopoulos and on ABC, Fox News, Bob Schieffer there on Face the Nation. A lot of good dialogue that exists there. I think the debates have been not perfect by any means, but you get a sense of who the candidates are and what they think about some of the critical issues that are on the agenda. Tomorrow night, as I indicated earlier, from Nevada, Brian Williams and Tim Russert will be on stage with the three leading Democratic candidates at this point. Obviously, there's enormous concern about what's going to happen to the American economy and with foreclosures, in addition to playing out who is responsible for Iraq and where do we go from here on Iraq. And my guess is that we'll see a great deal more of discussion about that tomorrow night.
among just the three of them, so we'll get a better sense of it.
And Tom, I've got to ask you, because it's the 60s, which is the subject of your book, Boom, Hillary Clinton Says Martin Luther King Raised the Issues Around Race. It took a president, LBJ, to get it done with the Voting Rights Act. What do you think of that formula?
Well, I think technically it was correct. I think that probably she could have done it by paying a little more tribute to Dr. King, but certainly her record with civil rights, and she described in the past the great moral crusade that he led. And in my own book, she says she pays tribute to what happened with the civil rights movement. Is out of the 60s, if you're an African American, life is a lot better for you now than it was then. But the civil rights movement, led by Dr. King, took enormous courage. He was a moral visionary that I think will stand the test of time forever. But at some point, you had to codify in our legal system the issues that he was putting before the American people, and it takes a president and a Congress to do that, and it takes great courage on their part as well. So it was not just one or the other, but a combination of the two. It began from the ground up. It moved to Congress, and a president got it passed, and it was a president who had not necessarily been sympathetic to civil rights before and thought that there would be a big political penalty for the Democratic Party, his party, by having had that happen. He said, we've just lost the South.
Mickey Kaus, 20 seconds here. Mea culpa's all over in the last week. Is it going to change American campaign coverage this year, this election?
I think people will be very leery of piling on a presumed loser the way they did Hillary in New Hampshire.
So a little more breathing space, maybe for everyone, and certainly for the voters to cast their own ballots, make their own decisions. Mickey Kaus with Slate.com, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks, Tom.
And Tom Brokaw, the new book is Boom. Mr. Brokaw, great to have you. Please come again. Thanks for speaking up last week.
Be happy to do it, Tom. Thanks.
Tom Brokaw, former NBC TV nightly news anchor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.